Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Zealand Initiative podcast. Today, I'm delighted to have with me Professor Abhishek Saha. He's a professor of mathematics at Queen Mary University of London. He's apparently a number theorist, I read on the website. So welcome, Abhishek, to the New Zealand Initiative podcast.
Thank you, James. Very nice to be here.
Can you maybe briefly tell people what is a number theorist?
So number theory is a branch of mathematics that tries to understand the structure of the numbers, like the most basic numbers, like 1, 2, 3, 4. But there are hidden structures there, like how many prime numbers there are and how they are distributed. So essentially, number theory starts with the very simple idea that you have a notion of counting, and it builds up from there to get really complicated theorems and results that we can prove by logic. So it's I enjoy doing it. It is what one would classify as pure mathematics. It has applications like to cryptography and so on, but a lot of the work I do is very abstract, and it's just a lot of fun.
Right. I mean, it sounds interesting. It sounds like it's complicated, too, and you probably have a lot on your hands just doing number theory. So I reached out to you because I know you've been active on social media, on X, and you've been active also writing pieces, for example, for the Heterodox Academy. And so I know that you've been active in this field of academic freedom. So how did you get drawn into that?
So I guess I got actively drawn into it about a year and a half ago when this new legislation called the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Act was passing through the UK Parliament. And it was a stage where the legislation was having some trouble because the House of Lords had just removed a very crucial part of the legislation, which was going to give it real teeth and produce some of its enforcement mechanisms. So I got in touch with an organization called the Free Speech Union that's based in the UK, which was campaigning for this bill. And I asked them, like, is there anything I can do to help? Because this is not a good development, because we are not in a good place at all with academic freedom, and we need this law. And the person who is the director, Toby Young, he wrote back straight away to me saying that, you know, it might be helpful if you could arrange some kind of a letter to the minister who is involved. And I'd never done that kind of thing before, but I was, okay, let's try and do that. So since I only know mathematicians, I wrote a letter and got some help editing it and circulated it to mathematicians who I thought might be interested in putting their signatures on. So in the end, we got only about a dozen signatures, not a huge number, from academic mathematicians who were, some of whom were quite prominent at UK universities. But I think what was also useful was that the minister who was involved in this bill, Claire Coutinho, she has a degree in mathematics. So we thought maybe she would look at it a bit sympathetically, having a letter from mathematicians. And it worked in some sense. We got some publicity. We had a big article in the Telegraph newspaper. And then the minister wrote back to me saying, like, she was really concerned about this and about the kind of issues they're raising. So she invited me to meet with her. And I met with her over Zoom. That was during the pandemic, for about half hour. And I was quite happy to see that she shared many of the concerns that we had raised. And then the next day in Parliament, she kind of brought back the provision that they had removed from the bill. So obviously, I'm not saying that our letter was the only thing that made a difference, but clearly she was hearing from a lot of people who were really concerned that the House of Lords had removed this provision. So that's how I kind of got involved.
Yeah, no, I mean,
and a few months later, the bill passed. Yeah. And yeah, I can tell you more about the act, but that was basically the starting point.
That's great. No, I think people can make a difference. I mean, as perhaps you've shown. I want to get back to this provision and what they were going to take away and what you insisted on keeping in and how important that was. But maybe just let's go right back to even before the bill was passed. So you said there at some point that you contacted Toby Young and you said to him, we really need to do something about academic freedom. There are lots of people out there who actually think, you know, we don't actually need to do anything about academic freedom. This is all a kind of moral panic. It's the right-wing press. What's your experience as an academic? Did we actually need this bill in the UK?
Absolutely, we need this bill because universities have not successfully protected academic freedom, especially in the last decade or so. They have, I think, too often bowed to pressures, both internal and external, to, for example, the high-profile cases that make the news are things like speaking events being cancelled. But I think that's just the tip of the iceberg. What's really happened is that there is a dominant narrative around controversial issues around race and sex and gender and political topics that might very controversial. And in each of them, I think the university administration often, when someone in the university, like an academic, puts forward a narrative that challenges the existing orthodoxy, then there's often like a protest or other academics try to silence them, and the universities have not stood up for their own academics. They have bowed to various people within and from outside. And this also, in addition to having academics sanctioned or dismissed, which we have seen in some cases, there's also a big chilling effect going on throughout the UK academia. A survey from, I think, 2017 found that 1 in 3 UK academics was self-centering. And that's 7 years ago. And I think things have gotten much worse in the next 3 to 5 years. So, yeah, and I think that's a big deal, because in universities, we should be able to express our opinions without worrying that we will our promotion prospects will be affected, or we will be disciplined, or that we might even be dismissed. And I think this bill was necessary, unfortunately, and I think it can go a big way in making a difference.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'm actually co-writing a report at the moment on academic freedom in New Zealand, and we have the same issue here, and it's the same kind of type of evidence, too, that we have, you know, a reasonably small number of big issues or big episodes, I should say, sort of people being deplatformed or talks, you know, people trying to deplatform talks, that sort of thing.
Right.
But then this iceberg metaphor is quite a good one. You know, that's the tip of the iceberg, but there's evidence also that everybody else feels chilled. Everyone else feels intimidated, or maybe not everybody else, but a lot of people. And in our case, too, we know that, because we've done, I think, 3 surveys now. Heterodox New Zealand Group, which is a chapter of Heterodox Academy, which is a group of academics concerned about this type of things. Heterodox New Zealand did a survey of New Zealand undergraduates. And then the Free Speech Union, the New Zealand version of the Free Speech Union, Toby Young led one. They also did 2 surveys, 2022 and 2023, where they surveyed academics. And yeah, we got similar results where, you know, not all academics were saying they're worried, but, you know, big proportions of academics were saying that they felt like they couldn't express views on certain issues. And it's very similar issues too, right? It's these new orthodoxies around race and sex and sexuality and gender. And there are differences.
Absolutely.
Like in New Zealand, actually the thing that New Zealand academics feel most uncomfortable talking about is actually the Treaty of Waitangi. And I'd be impressed if you've even heard of that, because it's a very New Zealand specific thing. It's it was a treaty signed between Maori, the native peoples of New Zealand, and the British Crown. And it's come to have a sort of totemic status in New Zealand politics and law. And I don't want to go into it very deeply, probably because I'm not a historian. I don't perfectly understand all the issues. But it's a classic issue, something that academics should be able to talk about. You know, they should be able to discuss that from a historical angle, from a legal angle, etc. And they don't feel that they can.
Yeah.
So
I think a lot of people, a lot of people say that maybe not every academic is being chilled, and most people can get along with their day jobs. And that may be true. But I think the most important point is that, and this is a point that Arif Ahmed, who is the new free speech czar, and said by the new legislation, he said in a speech at King's College last year that free speech is and always has been a counter-majoritarian principle. It's literally there to protect minority views. So he put a useful metaphor that saying it's okay that self-censorship only affects a minority is saying that it's okay that poor healthcare only affects people who are unwell.
Yeah,
I think that's a really good way to look at it.
Yeah, I suppose because the majority on any particular issue will not have a problem speaking, right? Because they're the majority.
Exactly.
Although it's interesting, because it's not the views which are sacred in the university are not quite the views that are held by the majority of the public, right? It's more that there's a kind of internal majority within the universities. And that's another thing we can get at through surveys. If you ask academics in most Anglophone countries, you know, what their political views are, there's a massive skew to the left. And that's not something that I necessarily deplore in itself. I think that you know, in an ideal world, we could have a situation where maybe there are a lot more folks are from the left, and they could still, you know, defend other academics' rights to speak on certain issues and disagree with them. But, you know, human nature being what it is, we have these tendencies to think in tribal ways. And of course, as you say, there's all this other evidence that people are being shut down, and they do feel intimidated. But anyway, let's just step back once more. So you feel that there is this problem. I agree with you, at least I know that this is the case in New Zealand as well. So then there's this bill that's brought in that goes through the political process, the Higher Education Freedom of Speech Bill. So just very simply, to people who've never heard of what this bill is, what does this bill in the UK do?
Right. So I think it's a very important piece of legislation that will have a big impact. So it first of all introduces new duties for universities to protect, promote, secure, and create a culture of free speech on campus. Now, these duties are not completely new because some of it was there in previous legislation. But what is really special about this law is that it creates two new mechanisms of enforcement that have real teeth and which can lead to significant fines and reputational damage. So one of them is like the first port of call, which is so the so-called complaint scheme, which is expected to get into effect from the 1st of August this year. So that means that anyone whose free speech rights have been breached and who have suffered some degree of harm as a result can make a complaint to the regulator, the Office for Students, and this is completely free for anyone to do. And then they are going to look at it and they can issue recommendations to universities about what they can do if the complaint is upheld. And then there is a second means of enforcement called the statutory tort, and that is the legal backstop that says that, all right, if the complaint scheme doesn't work, you can actually take them to court, and the court can award damages, they can fine universities, and they can do injunctions. So there's a lot of legal teeth there. So these are the two new mechanisms of enforcement that I think will make it effective and create real incentive for universities to take their new duties seriously. And lastly, it creates a new position called the Director of Free Speech and Academic Freedom, which I referred to earlier as the Free Speech Czar. And that position is a new position created at the Regulator's Office for Students. And that is currently the person who has been appointed is Arif Ahmed, who is a brilliant person for this job because he's always been an advocate for academic freedom. And his role is kind of to give guidance to the universities about how they should implement this new legislation and to oversee the complaint scheme. So overall, I think because of the new enforcement mechanisms and regulatory regime, this act, it's now an act and it'll have a big impact. And we're already seeing that on the ground with how universities are reacting to this.
Okay, so one objection that I've heard here and I've seen in other countries too from academics is, well, hold on, universities are supposed to be autonomous, and it's very dangerous if we start having government action and legislation that's clamping down on that autonomy. Isn't that a fair objection to this?
Yes, it is fair to say that this reduces university autonomy. But then I think I would take a step back and ask, why do we have university autonomy? And from my point of view, the reason to have university autonomy is so that the people who make up the university, the academics, the students, they can freely explore topics and have their teaching and research done without interference from the government. But what this bill is doing is it's not interfering with research and teaching. It's in fact trying to protect these academics and students from doing exactly what university autonomy is supposed to do. So I think we should not think of university autonomy as an absolute good in itself. Yes, it is a good thing because in most cases it does help universities run themselves in a way that helps academic freedom. But as we have seen in the last 10 years, universities have not been using their autonomy in that way. They are in fact often using their autonomous powers to discipline academics who stray from the orthodoxy. And I think it's completely legitimate in that case that government steps in to put in these protections so that the original aims, which people might, which be, which was often the real reason to have this autonomy, those aims are protected.
Yeah, that's right. I agree with that. I think that, universities are public institutions in the UK, I think with one exception.
Absolutely.
And in New Zealand, all eight universities are public institutions, they're getting taxpayer money. And I think that the taxpayers believe that that money is going towards these institutions, which are supposed to be open fora, and they're supposed to be engaged in investigation and debate and discussion. And so there's an argument
Correct.
that if they're not doing that, then maybe the government should actually step in. And in New Zealand, it's an even easier argument to make because in the Education Act, which sets up New Zealand universities, it actually says quite clearly that universities have to have academic freedom and that this includes the
Right.
capacity of academic staff and students to voice unpopular and controversial opinions. But there's still an issue with it. Anyway, let's go back now to, so you talked about why there's a problem. You talked about this bill that's come in that has brought in these three new things. You can make a complaint to the Office of Students. There's a statutory tort, so you can create a kind of legal process. And there's also the free speech czar that's come in.
Right.
So let's go back now to this provision that you were trying to make sure they didn't take away. So the beginning, right. You were saying that they were trying to water down the bill in some way. So exactly. Can you talk, let's go back to that. What was that?
That was a statutory tort. So the statutory tort was the provision that faced the most pushback in the later stages of the bill. And this pushback, I think, came from the House of Lords, which is the upper house of the UK Parliament, which has many members who have been previously involved in university higher level administration. So the House of Lords has good connections, I think, with the top administrators at many universities. And I think the pressure may have indirectly come from the universities themselves, because they, for obvious reasons, they did not want this big new legal risk, because they realized that the statutory tort could take them to court. And if one goes anything like the statutory tort that is in there in other legislation, like the Equality Act, as someone mentioned in the parliamentary debate, a single case could lead to financial loss of over £100,000 for a university. And if there are many such cases like that, you can see why universities were worried about the statutory tort. So that was the provision that faced the most pushback. And the House of Lords in December 2022 decided to completely remove the statutory tort. They said, we don't need it. It's gone from the bill. And that's the point that I kind of got involved. And what happened after that in February of 2023 was that the minister, she brought the statutory tort back in full. And then there was a bit of ping pong between the two houses. So what we have ended up with in the final act is that the statutory tort is there, but it has a couple of caveats. So it says that if in most cases, it would have to first go through the complaint scheme before you can use the statutory tort. However, if it's something urgent, then you can use it straight away. And that's an injunction. If it's an injunction that you want the court to do, then you can use it immediately. But in other cases, you have to first go through the complaint scheme. So that's the compromise that we ended up with. I think it is still strong enough in the final form of the act that it would create enough incentives for universities to take their duty seriously.
So the compromise was to do with the idea that there might be vexatious litigation. In other words, lots of people would be taking universities to court when they could have just sort of found another way to deal with the issue, like the complaint mechanism. Is that the idea?
Right. Yeah, that's the idea. And the idea is that it should be more like a legal backstop than something that people can use straight away without going through the internal or the complaint scheme process. So I was not completely happy about that, because I thought it should always be there, but I think we still have it immediately for cases that you might need it immediately. Like, for example, if someone is about to be dismissed, or if a speaker is about to be cancelled, or a student about to be thrown out of a course for something he or she has said, in those cases, one could presumably just go to a court and use the statutory tort and ask for an injunction to prevent that from happening. So for the cases that, many of the cases that we need it, we still have it immediately. In other cases, we have the complaint scheme, which is free. And if that does not work, you can go to the court. So I think we have ended up in a place that is still has enough teeth and for the legislation to work.
Okay. And so if you do want to go the injunction route, you'd presumably have to present some kind of evidence that you needed to get it done quickly.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so what stage are we at now? My understanding is the bill made it through the Lords with this compromise, and it's now in force in the UK. Is that right?
Yes.
Is it just England, or is it is it Scotland as well? Or?
Yeah, it is only England. It applies to England and Wales, but in reality, it really only applies to England, because Wales is not quite under the Office for Students Regulator, which is involved in many of these provisions. So it's really only for England. I mean, I think Scotland could do with a similar piece of legislation, but it got passed last year. It got passed in 2023 in May, but it is not fully in force yet. So the main provisions, the statutory tort, the complaint scheme, the new duties, they're expected to come in force in August of this year. So in a few months from now. And the last year has really been a time for the regulator to kind of set forth how it's going to implement. It has run several consultations, many of which I'm involved in as in my capacity as members of other free speech groups that exist in the UK. So a lot has been happening, but we expect that on the 1st of August, the bill will really come into force and one can start using these provisions.
Okay, so you can't use them yet. So you can't really tell me, you know, how things have been going now that the bill's actually active, because it's not quite active yet. But
Right. Do
you think that...
But there has been some stuff going on nonetheless.
Right. I was going to say, I mean, do you think that because universities know that these provisions are going to be active soon, they're trying to sort of put their house in order already?
Absolutely. So I think we saw it already since the thing passed in May, one of the things that the bill asks every university to do is to have a code of practice for free speech. So every university has to have a free speech policy that lays out it what it's going to do to protect and promote free speech in compliance with the new legislation, how it is going to ensure that events can be run without getting deplatformed, and so on. So every university has to do that before August 4th, the 1st this year. So they have been doing it over the last year. And we have been seeing that, for example, in my own university, we have now a new code that has been set up, and I'm sure other universities are doing the same. And universities have been taking their new duties seriously. As far as I can see, they are much less, much more hesitant to clamp down on free speech. And we are going to see a lot more of that from the 1st of August. Also, I think because of all the excitement and activity around the bill, we have seen a lot of on the ground movement, a lot of grassroots movement springing up in the UK with academic freedom organizations that are being set up at different universities or at different cities, which bring academics together who care and are worried about the environment in free speech and academic freedom. And that has been really helpful with bringing people together and raising awareness. So I think over the last year, a lot of positive things have happened despite the bill not fully being enforced yet. And a lot of that has happened because of the bill. We have had conferences involving university vice chancellors being talking about how they can protect academic freedom. And we saw none of that before the bill passed. So I think we have been seeing things happening as a result.
Yeah, I think that that's the case in New Zealand too, just with a new government who stated there was actually, it's a coalition of center-right parties. And in the coalition agreement, there's actually provision to, I think, fine universities if they don't fulfill their obligations to academic freedom. And I think after that, even though they haven't actually done anything in legislative terms yet, vice chancellors have started using the language of free speech. But I mean, I think that it's also sort of quite easy to use the language of free speech and not actually follow through and not actually protect it properly. So we might actually need something more in New Zealand. So on that topic, actually, I mean, this is why I wanted to get you on. I mean, I want to know about the situation in the UK, but I want to know about the situation in the UK partly because it might be an interesting guide to what we do here in New Zealand. So I mean, I think that there's always a temptation, and there's certainly a lot of people in New Zealand who are saying, well, do we really need legislation? I mean, there's all these obvious objections around university autonomy. I think there's a belief that, you know, New Zealanders are kind of pragmatic folks. They don't like confrontation. There's no need to sort of force this issue. Why not just try to sort of win hearts and minds in the university? What do you think about that? Do you think that would just be a good route to take for us, just to sort of drop the legislative option and just try and sort of win back the university in other ways?
I think that would take, if it works, it will take a long time, and it would not, but I think just winning hearts and minds as evidence in the rest of the world has not shown to work is not sufficient. I think most countries need some kind of legal backstop or some kind of legal framework that tells the university that they must protect free speech and academic freedom, and there are consequences if we don't. We saw that in the UK, this has not worked, and the legislation was necessary. We have seen in the US that there's something similar has happened. Universities have not been taking things seriously, and at least in the US, the First Amendment protects public universities in their free speech duties. They cannot violate free speech duties without, in many cases, falling afoul of the First Amendment, which would not work in for private universities. And that's one reason why even the First Amendment has not been enough. So in many states in the US, we are now seeing laws being passed, especially against the excesses of what's called DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I think, of course, there can be a danger of overreach in legislation. You don't want to use academic freedom legislation you don't want to draft it badly so that it might end up suppressing academic freedom of the opposite side that you think are behind all of this, because that is not the route I think we should be going down. And we have seen a little bit of that in some parts of the US.
That's right.
I do think some legislation is needed. And I don't know the situation in New Zealand as well as I know the situation in the UK. Mm-hmm. But from whatever I have heard from you and I've read, I think some kind of legislation would be useful to have that goes beyond just nice words and winning hearts and minds at universities.
Right. I think I agree with you about the states. I mean, I'm guessing you're referring to the situation in Florida, where I think the state government under Governor Ron DeSantis has been doing things like shutting down or maybe sort of taking over certain university departments and I think getting rid of some personnel and bringing in new personnel. Yeah, I'm also very nervous about that kind of thing.
Can't be taught, like even if, for example, there is critical race theory, which I'm not a fan of and which some of the theories like that have been behind a lot of the chilling effects we have seen because people try to cancel those who don't agree. But the answer is not to say you cannot talk about these theories. The answer is, I think, to protect academic freedom for everyone so that people can talk about what they want and freely explore controversial topics and oppose critical race theory without worrying about their job. I think that should be the answer. And we have seen some states in the US put in that kind of legislation, which I think is good. I think there are so many different laws going through various U.S. Legislative houses at the moment. Some of them are good, some of them are not so good. And I think there is a lot to learn from different countries and states, different laws, and to take the best pieces and have some kind of legal protection for academic freedom in all the countries, I think would be something that one should consider.
Okay, so let's finish up maybe with the thought experiment. You are now the commissioner for free speech in New Zealand. Congratulations. We're going to give you massive powers, and basically you're going to be able to design the free speech union, the free speech legislation of your heart's desire. So what would you, what kind of things would you put in a New Zealand bill that would, you know, guarantee free speech at our universities?
Right. So there is obviously no way to guarantee free speech, but one could try and make things better. So I would, first of all, have the legal duties spelled out clearly. So, for example, academics should be able to freely explore controversial topics without having their chances of promotion reduced and so on. Similarly, for processes like recruitment, speaking events and so on. So there should be, the duties should be clearly set out. And then I would have enforcement mechanisms. So universities that do not do that, or academics or students who feel, or even visiting speakers who feel that their duties, that their free speech rights have been breached, there should be easy way to address the situation. Similar to the complaint scheme, I would have that. I would have a legislative backstop of some kind so that universities can't say that, all right, we are just not going to follow the law. Then they should face consequences. I would be careful that usually there are caveats around these duties, because you do want to have sensible restrictions, like people should not talk loudly in the library, right? No one wants to stop that kind of thing. So one has to be clear that any kind of thing that could be conceivably viewed as restriction on speech should be viewpoint neutral. It should not be based on the content or the viewpoint, but it should be based on where or how or the occasion. So I would be careful around topics like that. And I think also it's important that beyond the law, one would have to give guidance to universities on how one should implement it, because most university staff members or even managers, head of departments, they're not going to read the law carefully. They need to be told practically with examples. These are the kind of things that happen in universities. This is how we expect you to react. So the Office of Students has recently set out a guidance to UK universities in draft form, which should be finalized over the summer. And it's a brilliant document, I think. It has 30 examples of different situations that cover things like diversity statements in hiring, or things like various agreements universities could put in with foreign partners and so on. So I think one should have concrete guidance given following the legislation about how these things should be practically implemented. So these are a few things I would be looking at.
That sounds great, actually. Maybe I'll try and get you in as the free speech commissioner. I'll talk to the prime minister. It's a small country. I'll do my best. So, okay, final question then. I said the last one was the final one, but this one, it just occurred to me that, so in the UK, I think there's no secret that the polls are suggesting that Sir Keir Starmer and the Labour Party are probably going to form the next government in the UK. What do the Labour Party leadership think of this bill? Is there a chance that they might revoke it?
Yeah, so I'm worried about that, because during the legislative stages, the Labour Party voted against the bill at every stage. So it basically just passed due to the Conservative Party having a majority. So obviously, one would be worried that they would try to scrap or weaken the legislation in some way. I think the chances that they would completely remove the legislation is low. And in fact, I'm quite optimistic that they might actually let things be, at least for a while, keep the legislation, keep Arif Ahmed at the head. And I think one reason is that I think My feeling is that Keir Starmer is a pragmatic person. He's not going to just go and break things. But more than that, I think recent events around, for example, in world politics in Israel and Gaza and so on, have shown that I think it has made clear to many people on the left here that threats to free speech can come from any side of the political spectrum. It's not just people who are against the new, against all these equality and diversity topics. It's not just them being silenced. It's also people who are pro-Palestine or pro things that we might consider as more left-wing causes. They're also being silenced from the other side. And I think people have seen that there is value to free speech. And I think I'm hoping that the Labour leadership sees that. So I'm more optimistic than I was a year ago that this legislation will stay and that they will not try to mess things up too much. So obviously, I'm not an expert in how things are in politics. I'm not a politician. I don't know to what degree the Labour leadership is going to listen to some extreme activists who actually do want the bill to be scrapped. We'll have to find out. But my feeling is that there is some reasons to be optimistic that things will that this legislation will stay.
No, I don't have a crystal ball either, so your guess is as good as mine. Probably better because you're actually in the
Yeah.
UK. All right, so thanks so much, Professor Abhishek Sahar, Queen Mary University of London. Thanks for this interview, and also thanks for all the work you're doing, which can be risky.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on this podcast. Thanks. It was nice talking to you, James.
Cheers.